tired, so I'd gone to meet Michael myself. It was always unnerving to be alone in the woods after dark. I wasn't afraid of whatever animals lurked behind the trees. Mostly, I was scared I'd get lost, that I'd wander out the wrong side into town, shivering and terrified, and everyone in Whitley would act like I was Frankenstein's monster. That didn't happen, though. Michael was there in our meeting place, just like he'd promised, a lit cigarette dangling from his lips. "Those things will kill you," I said, handing him the envelope. He crushed the cigarette under his boot and shrugged. "I didn't realize you'd ridden here on your high horse," he said. "His name is Applesauce, and he's a Palomino." I motioned toward the bags. "This everything?"
"Sure is,"
Michael said, counting out the money. He put on a tough act, like he was some thug drug dealer instead of a Starbucks barista.
"What happened to your bodyguard?"
"He's taking a sick day." God, I was going to kill Nick. The bags looked heavy, and I didn't know how I was going to carry all of them back without him. Michael's cell phone vibrated, and he pulled it out, checking. He made a face.
"Gotta head back.
But it was a pleasure doing business with you, sweetheart." I hated when he called me that. "The pleasure's all yours," I said, and somehow managed to cram everything into my backpack.
"What a shame."
He smirked at me, and the leaves crunched under his feet as he walked away. I clicked my flashlight onto its highest setting, heading in the opposite direction. I was halfway across the grass when I saw Lane sitting in the gazebo, looking miserable. At first, I thought I was imagining it, that the shadows were up to some new trick, making me see boys in the dark. But when I got closer, I saw that it really was him, hunched and upset and sitting on the steps. "Lane?" I called. It was just the two of us outside. Everyone else was at the movie night, or in the cottages, or asleep. And I wondered why he wasn't at any of those places, why he was leaning against the peeling paint of the gazebo, looking like the universe had just punched him in the gut.
"Hey,"
he said. "Bad night?"
That would be an understatement.
My backpack was heavy, and I'd had to walk pretty far through the woods wearing the thing. I was exhausted, and all I wanted was to get back to the dorm, take off my boots, and climb into the shower. But I couldn't leave him there. He'd been nothing but nice to me, and then I'd stomped all over him, trying to put out the embers of a fire that had never existed. Yesterday in the library, I wouldn't have blamed him for sitting back and doing nothing when Mrs. Hogan nearly caught us stealing internet. But he'd run up and distracted her, making up a dumb story to save me. Even after the way I'd acted. Even when he didn't have to. "Move over," I said. I shrugged out of my backpack and sat down next to him on the steps. We stared out at the woods, the trees, the sky, all of the things that didn't belong to Latham, that weren't put here behind iron gates for us to cough over. There was barely any space between us, and I hadn't quite realized how intimate it would be, sitting there together in the dark. I'd interrupted his solitude, and I could feel him wondering why. "I used to come to this gazebo a lot," I said, "back when I first got here. It felt almost magical, like if anything at Latham could transport you somewhere else, it was probably this."
"I thought you hated me,"
Lane muttered. "I guess I deserved that." "False alarm," I said. "It turns out that what I really hate is TB.
"Yeah, me too."
His shoulders were slumped, and the stubble that shadowed his jawline looked more defeated than deliberate. Up close, I could see that his jeans were too loose, and the belt I'd made fun of was actually necessary. He looked exhausted, like he hadn't slept for days, and I had no idea what to do or say or how to apologize to this strange, sad boy who was so different than I'd imagined. "I only hated you because I thought you were an asshole to me when we were 13, I said, all of it spilling out in a clumsy, unplanned mess. It was stupid and dumb, and if I'd thought about it for 2 seconds, I would have realized that the girls in my cabin had faked the whole thing, so I'm sorry. I was horrible to you, and you didn't deserve it, and you still saved me from Mrs. Hogan."
"Who's Mrs. Hogan?"
he asked, coughing a little. "The librarian," I said.
He nodded, filing away the information. How long have you been here? He asked. 15 months? Maybe 16, depending on whether it's October yet, or if I only think it is. It's October 4th, he said automatically. Got the weather forecast for me, too? Sorry, he shrugged. Hey, can I tell you something? I said sure, expecting the same panic attack that everyone had in their first few weeks at Latham, about not wanting to die here. I braced myself for a conversation so predictable you'd almost think it was a symptom of tuberculosis. And then he told me how his girlfriend had written his eulogy as her college admissions essay. I hadn't been expecting that, at all. But then, nothing about Lane was what I expected. He was familiar and unfamiliar, like a song I'd heard a different version of and whose lyrics I couldn't quite remember. I sat there as it poured out of him, what she'd written, how she hadn't even seemed sorry, and how fucked up it was that she saw him like that. I hadn't known any of that was going on with him. Sometimes I forgot that everyone who arrived here left behind their actual lives, often in a hurry and frequently unfinished. And when I thought about how I'd acted all week, like he owed me this big apology for even existing, I felt even worse. She doesn't know what she's talking about, I said. Yeah, but that doesn't make it suck any less. Lane sighed. I'm just so tired of everyone going on about how I'm sick and how sorry they are. I can't remember the last time anyone had a normal conversation with me. I couldn't either. I was so used to it that I hardly even noticed. If a stranger on the street had asked me to rate my pain on a scale of 1 to 10, I probably wouldn't have blinked. Do you know what my mom talks about? I said. Ice baths and miracle herbs. She seriously calls them that. Miracle herbs. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but if there was some miracle out there, I don't think they'd sell it in Whole Foods. Lane snorted and I went on, encouraged. So, yeah, talking to people? Totally depressing. We should off ourselves right now so we can be done with people caring how we feel. For a moment, Lane thought I was serious. Then he realized I was full of shit, and he laughed. When you put it that way, he said. Your ex-girlfriend cared about you. She cared in a shitty way, but that's why it took her so long to say anything. It was cold out, and the wind picked up then. I pulled my hands inside the sleeves of my sweatshirt, shivering. Ex-girlfriend, Lane mumbled. That's so weird. He was quiet a moment, lost in thought. What? I asked. I was just thinking how having an ex-girlfriend is one of those things that isn't true until someone says it. Like, we all had TB before we were diagnosed. We just didn't know we did. But breaking up isn't like that. Being single is something you're aware of the moment it happens to you. Or, if you're like me, being single is a chronic condition since birth. I said it like I was joking, even though it wasn't funny. Wait, so you and Nick are in... He sounded surprised. Everyone assumed Nick and I were a thing, everyone. But as much fun as Nick and I had hanging out together, I had zero interest in going there. Nick? I made a face. God, no. He's practically my brother. We're partners in crime. Lane winced at my joke, like it dredged up something painful. Hannah and I used to call ourselves lab partners in crime, he explained, before she decided to eulogize me for shits and giggles. He leaned forward and propped his chin on his hand, looking tremendously sorry for himself. It'll be okay, I said. Will it? Lane murmured like he didn't believe me. Here's a secret, I said. There's a difference between being dead and dying. We're all dying. Some of us die for 90 years and some of us die for 19. But each morning, everyone on this planet wakes up one day closer to their death. Everyone. So living and dying are actually different words for the same thing, if you think about it. I'd thought about it for a long time, even though I never said it out loud. Nick and I joked around a lot, but I didn't confess anything serious to him. We weren't that kind of friends. I didn't have that kind of friends. The ones you could talk to, without being afraid someone would cut in with a witty remark, trying to get a laugh, and ruining the whole thing. But there was something about sitting on the steps with Lane that made it feel okay to let the darkness spill out.
So, basically, I'm saying the glass is half empty of TB, and you're saying the glass is half full of it?
He asked. That was a clever way to put it. Pretty much, I said.
Awesome. I was looking for a new metaphor about being sick.
Lane gave a hint of a smile. My personal favorite is the one about the invisible hand of tuberculosis trying to grab hold of us all.
Show me on this doll exactly where the invisible hand touched you,
Lane said, his voice serious. We laughed. He had a nice laugh, a sort of embarrassed chuckle, unlike mine, which was completely silent as though someone had turned off the volume. I shivered again and balled the sleeves of my sweatshirt into my fists, but it didn't help. It's getting pretty cold, I said. We should head back. We climbed to our feet, and I shouldered my giant backpack. I could feel Lane staring, but thankfully he didn't ask me about it. We walked back to the dorms together in silence. Not the awkward kind, but a nice, contemplative silence. Usually spending any amount of time with someone was a forcible reminder of how much I'd rather be alone. Even my friends could grate on me sometimes, although I tried not to let on. But talking with Lane felt easy. Nice. Like being alone, but less lonely.
So, Lane said when we reached my dorm, thanks for keeping me company.
I shrugged, like it was no trouble. Well, fresh air is supposedly good for us, I said.
Breathing. The miracle cure everyone's been looking for.
He smiled at me. We were at the bottom of the porch steps. Gnats swarmed the light above the screen door, and the ancient glider creaked softly. It felt like we were waiting for something, but I didn't know what. And then the quiet evaporated as everyone returned to the cottages, surrounding us with a maelstrom of laughter and conversations and coughing. The movie had ended. A couple of girls from the second floor pushed past us without apology, and suddenly, standing there felt unbearably awkward. So I told Lane I'd see him around, and then I went inside.
Chapter 9. Lane. I liked Sadie's theory about living and dying being the same thing, and I wanted to believe it. But the thing was, although I might not have been dying, I wasn't really living either. I was doing what I'd always done, keeping my head down, working hard, planning for the future, and trying to ignore the present. Like Harbor, Latham was some place to get through on the way to somewhere else. I had an appointment with Dr. Behrens on Sunday, and when he pulled up my vitals on his tablet, I could tell I was in trouble. He stared down at the screen, his expression dismayed. Lane, buddy, what's going on here? He asked. Nothing. I tried to look innocent, like I didn't know what he was talking about, but I had a pretty good idea. I still wasn't feeling that great, although it was nowhere near as bad as it had been on Saturday morning. I'd been so focused on keeping up with my schoolwork that I'd ignored my test scores, the ones I couldn't study for. I'd overdone it, and now Dr. Behrens was going to... What? Give me a strike for being sick? How are you feeling right now, on a scale of 1 to 10? 4, I thought. 2, I said. I wish I believed that. Dr. Behrens frowned, and I shifted uncomfortably, hating that he could tell. But you've lost weight, you're running a fever half the time, and you're barely sleeping. He said it like I was this grand disappointment, as though having a fever was as shameful as flunking an essay or forgetting to do my homework. I'd read enough about TB to have its list of symptoms memorized. Cough, fever, fatigue, chest pains, chills, loss of appetite, coughing up blood, weight loss. Right, but all of that's normal, I said. It's in the pamphlets or whatever. Dr. Behrens shook his head. New symptoms are always worrying. You should be getting better at Latham, not worse. I hated that he was right, that I wasn't okay, and this wasn't some bullshit checkup. I didn't want to be at Latham, but more than that, I didn't want to need to be here. I kept quiet, and Dr. Behrens sighed. I don't want to have to update your parents with news like this, he said, when earlier this week it looked like things were on the mend. They are, I insisted. I am. And then I fucking started coughing right there in his office. It was the air conditioning cranked up so high that I was shivering even in my Stanford hoodie. I took out my handkerchief just in time, and Dr. Behrens watched me, his face eerily calm and his gaze unnervingly sharp. I didn't cough up blood or sputum or anything, but it still sounded pretty rough. A decline like this worries me, he said, taking a stylus out of his lab coat pocket. So what we're going to do is make a couple of preventive changes. We'll add you to the monitor list so a nurse will check on you during rest periods to see if you need anything, and I'll put you down for a sleeping pill every night at 8. I stared at him in horror. You can't do that, I said. This couldn't be happening. I didn't need some nurse hovering over me and forcing me into bed when it was still so early. I'd never have any privacy or get anything done. I can fix it, I promised. Honestly, I didn't realize it was that bad or I would have eased up. Exactly. You were just trying to keep up with the schedule, but it was too taxing. So we'll make some accommodations and see if we can stave this off before... That's not what I meant, I interrupted. He had it all wrong, thinking that Latham was too much for me to handle, that I'd gotten worse from a couple of bullshit classes and nature walks. I'd been planning to ask him about doing my AP work, but now that I had to admit what was really going on, I knew he'd never allow it. So I confessed everything, how I'd been studying during the rest periods, that I wasn't having trouble sleeping, I was staying up to work. And sure, I wasn't feeling great, but I hadn't realized it had gotten that bad. I just didn't want to lose everything that I'd worked so hard for. I didn't want Latham to ruin my perfectly planned out future. After I finished, Dr. Behrens was quiet for a moment. I could feel his disapproval hovering there like a giant doom cloud. And then he sighed. Lane, he said, I don't think you understand how serious this is. I'm not suggesting you slow down. I'm insisting that you stop. You're not at school. You're in a medical facility, and you need to get with the program immediately. I'd never seen an adult look so angry at me, or so disappointed. I was actually being scolded for studying. In the weirdness of Latham House, where it was easier to fail your meals than your classes, I'd gotten it wrong once again. Can I trust you to do that? Dr. Behrens pressed. Or do I need to transfer you to the hospital wing for round-the-clock care? Because I'm going to be blunt here, Lane. If you keep going like this, that's where you'll wind up. It hit me then, as I sat on the crinkled paper of the exam table, how monumentally stupid I'd been. When I'd arrived at Latham, I hadn't felt that sick, so I'd figured I wasn't. And then I'd seen how easily that could change. I could either get better, or I could keep up with my old classes for my old life. I couldn't do both. Everyone else had known that, and I should have too. I just hadn't wanted to admit it, because admitting it meant acknowledging the possibility that the odds might not be in my favor. And that possibility was terrifying. I wasn't surrounded by sick kids. I was one of them. Yeah, I said hollowly. You can trust me. Good. Dr. Behrens smiled, and I tried to smile back, but I couldn't think of anything to smile about. Is there any way we could forget about the sleeping pills and nurse checks? I asked. I'll go to sleep at lights out and everything, I swear. The doctor considered this, staring at my chart. Please, I hoped, putting it out there into the universe for any deity that might be listening. I'll do the stupid nature walks and yoga if he just grants me this one thing, if he lets me keep some small measure of dignity in this place. All right, he said. We'll hold off for the time being, so long as I see an immediate improvement.
You will,
I promised, relieved. Fantastic. Dr. Behrens put away his stylus. Oh, and Lane, your hall nurse will come by shortly to collect any study materials that might be in your room. Of course she would, because it wasn't enough that I had to be here. Now I had no escape. I was completely severed from everything. So fine, I'd play by Dr. Behrens' rules, and once I got this TB thing under control and went home, I'd try to figure something out. But I'd rather get well enough to leave than stay sick enough for Dr. Behrens to keep me here. Just the thought of what it would mean to follow the schedule taped above my desk overwhelmed me. It would mean that just like everyone else, I was a patient here. One who was expected to endure an endless stretch of hours every afternoon with no internet and no phone and no friends and nowhere to go and nothing to do except lie in bed and wait. I saw now why everyone crowded the TV room and read graphic novels and ransacked the DVD shelves and saved their board games. Classes ended before lunch, and the teachers didn't assign homework. It was like Sadie had said, they wouldn't dare to give us less than an A. I thought about Sadie's group with their contraband internet, their mystery trips to the woods, the way I never saw Nick or Charlie hanging around the TV lounge in their sweatpants. When I'd first arrived, I'd thought they were troublemakers and that breaking the rules was wrong. But now the idea of getting in trouble sounded appealing. Being yelled at for something that wasn't on my medical chart would be great. I was sick of being perfect, and maybe it was okay not to be. Just for a while. Just at Latham. Maybe I could be a different version of myself here. One who didn't feel enormously guilty for watching a movie on a school night. Someone with a hobby that did nothing for my resume. Someone with friends, not just a friend group. When Sadie had joined me in the gazebo, and we'd sat there, talking about everything, I'd been so lost in my own misery that it hadn't quite dawned on me how amazing it felt for someone to understand. Someone who was going through the same thing. Sadie had made Latham seem like a common enemy to be laughed about, and for the first time in months, I hadn't felt panicked, and I hadn't felt alone. I'd gone about my life here all wrong, I saw that now, and I was determined to fix it. Have you ever driven somewhere with the GPS on, and you decide to stop off for a coffee or something? The GPS keeps giving you directions to your destination, keeps making this rerouting noise at every turn, like you've done something wrong. And suddenly, instead of blindly following what your GPS says, you're actively ignoring it, and getting angrier and angrier at the stupid machine for telling you to turn right. I'd always thought of myself as the passenger in this scenario. But as Nurse Monica went through my belongings, taking away my binders of makeup assignments and the books on my desk, and even my college brochures, I realized that I was the GPS. I was the one who hadn't understood about the detour and who kept stubbornly trying to get back en route. I'd been rerouting at every turn when the only thing to do was to stop protesting and go off course. I had my chance to fix things in French class on Tuesday. We were working silently at our desks again, and I kept glancing over at Sadie and her friends. I'd been trying to figure out how to approach them all morning because I didn't think I could stand another meal at Genevieve's table. Mr. Finnegan wasn't in the room.
He'd come in for about 2 seconds, written an assignment on the board,
and instructed us to work silently until he returned. Which, if last week was any indication, would be right before class ended. Back at Harbor, my honors French class had alternated between Socratic method verb conjugations and sitting in the computer lab with headphones on doing dictation. The whole thing was a nightmare. Latham's version of French, a catch-all combined class for anyone with the basics under their belt, felt like a total joke in comparison. We'd moved on from hospital visits to office jobs. I couldn't figure out why we were going over this stuff other than to keep us busy. To top it all off, the textbook was ancient. There was an entire dialogue about sending a fax. I flipped to the front of the book and took a look at the publication date. The book was a relic of the early 90s, stamped with a fancy seal proclaiming it property of the Whitley Preparatory School Library. I guessed someone had found a stack of them gathering dust and figured we could mend and make do. The assignment was easy, and I finished pretty quickly. I wished I'd brought a book or something else to work on, but it's not like I had too many options after Nurse Monica had ransacked my room. So I sat there, double and triple-checking my answers, and glancing over at Sadie. Her desk was beneath a window, and the sunlight caught the gold in her hair. She had on this striped sweater which had slipped off one shoulder, revealing the pale wing of her shoulder blade. She bent over her work, tapping her pencil against the textbook, this wonderful smile on her lips, like she was silently laughing at the assignment. And then Nick leaned across the aisle and dropped a folded note onto her desk. She opened it warily, and they whispered about something. Nick leaned back in his chair with a smirk. I watched as Sadie stood up, gathered her assignment, and walked to the front of the room. Everyone stopped what they were doing, unsure what was happening. And then Sadie put her things down on the teacher's desk next to Finnegan's travel mug. She smoothed her hair, an expression on her face like she was about to pull the best prank in the history of Latham.
"Bonjour, class,"
she said, plucking a whiteboard marker from the tray and uncapping it.
"Everyone take out a different colored pen, and we'll go over the assignment."
We all looked around, confused. Only Nick and Charlie were laughing like they knew the drill. Marina shook her head and put away her graphic novel with a grin. Finnegan hadn't mentioned anything about correcting the assignment. He still hadn't handed back any of our work from last week's classes.
"Exercise A. The answers are le bureau, l'ordinateur, l'imprimante, le graffeuse, and la classure,"
Sadie went on, writing each answer on the board.
"Does everyone have that?"
"Oui, madame,"
Nick called out, trying not to laugh. Everyone still looked confused.
"What are you doing?" Genevieve asked. "En français, Mademoiselle Rizer,"
Sadie chided. Genevieve muttered something under her breath and slid down in her seat, folding her arms.
"Exercise B," Sadie went on. "We'll do this one together. Let's go down the rows, starting with Charlie. Please read the full sentence out loud."
"Avez-vous pris des notes pendant la réunion?"
Charlie read, sounding bored. As everyone down the rows read their answers to the assignment, I tried to figure out Sadie's game. We'd gone over the homework like this every day at my old school. It was just normal. Just school. Which must have been the point. To do something so normal that Mr. Finnegan would feel ridiculous getting upset over it. It was an interesting idea. A way to screw with the teacher that didn't actually cause any trouble.
"Section C," Sadie said. "Angela, I think it's you."
"J'avais une pièce de papier,"
Angela recited.
"Bien."
"Wait, that's wrong," I said without thinking. Everyone turned to stare at me.
"It's une feuille de papier,"
I said, trying to play it off. "It's idiomatic."
"Is it now?"
Sadie grinned.
"Well, I think we've got ourselves a new substitute teacher. Levez-vous?"
She motioned for me to come to the front of the room, and I shook my head. No way was I getting up there while we were supposed to be working quietly in our seats. What if Finnegan came back? What if everyone hated me and started yelling for me to shut up and sit down? The ways in which this could go wrong were endless. But Sadie held out the marker, waiting. The whole room was watching. Even the kids who'd been gaming on their tablets. I wished I could take back my stupid grammar comment and possibly disappear, but Sadie and her friends were staring at me, and I realized with a sudden jolt that this was it. My chance to join the rebellion, my way into their circle. I'd been hoping for something more subtle, like making witty conversation in the lunch line, possibly about the milk cartons, but too late now. So I sighed and stood up, hoping I wouldn't regret it.
Classe, c'est bonjour to substitute teacher Lane.
Sadie pressed the marker into my hand with a smile.
Bonjour, Lane,
Sadie's friends called back, enjoying themselves immensely. And then she went back to her seat and left me there. I stared down at the textbook that was old enough to buy beer, trying to muster my nerve. I never did this sort of thing. I volunteered to pass back exam booklets, and I went to school sick so I wouldn't lose out on the perfect attendance award. I followed the rules because that was why rules existed, to be followed. At least, that's what I'd always believed. And now I was standing at the front of the room, not because the teacher wanted me to, but because Sadie had dared me. Because it was worth getting in trouble if it meant I didn't have to sit at Genevieve's table anymore. There was no such thing as an honor roll here, and no clubs that the teachers liked best. So I set my textbook on the desk and did an impression of my dad. I'd been stuck in his history class in the 9th grade, along with the other kids in the honors program who couldn't stand him. He was strict and a tough grader, and he didn't let anyone pee, even though his class was right after lunch. But mostly, he did this thing where he hit the board with the marker to stress his point, making eye contact with a specific student while he did it. No one whispered in his class. He was that terrifying.
Répétez plus vite,
I insisted, smacking the board with the marker and glaring at Angela. She giggled nervously and gave the correct answer.
Exactement, I said coldly, writing it down.
Angela sank down in her seat, pouting, and Genevieve shot her a sympathetic look. Sadie and her friends were in hysterics. Some of the other students were grinning. I went on, encouraged, and somehow managed not to break character. In middle school, I'd taken a drama class where we played improv games and acted out 2-page scenes. I'd wanted to sign up again in high school, but it would have ruined my class rank if I didn't take a weighted elective, so I'd picked up AP Art History instead. I'd forgotten how much I enjoyed stuff like this, how fun it was to step outside myself. I was on the second-to-last question when the laughter went totally quiet. Something was wrong, I could feel it. I turned. Finnegan stood in the doorway, staring at me, unsure what was going on. And to tell you the truth, I hardly knew either. It wasn't like the room was in chaos or anything. Far from it. The board was filled with neatly numbered corrections, and everyone was in their seats, quietly marking their answers, while I ran the class like Professor Snape was my spirit animal.
Qu'est-ce qui se passe là?
Finnegan demanded.
Rien,
I said, putting down the marker.
Sorry.
I hurried back to my seat, my heart pounding. Finnegan had caught me goofing off, and now I was going to catch hell. I expected him to yell or send me to some administrative office or kick me out. But he just shook his head, like he wasn't paid enough to deal with this kind of thing. He stared at the uncapped marker I'd left on his desk and at the board with Sadie's cursive scrawl and my neat printing, a pinched expression on his face like he didn't want to touch anything we might have used.
Someone erase this, he said, motioning toward the board. Genevieve.
Genevieve flounced to the front of the room and started wiping the board.
Everyone pass forward your work, he said. Then go to lunch. Sadie, stay behind, please.
I tore my assignment out of my notebook and passed it forward, glancing over at Sadie. She shrugged like it was no big deal, and I wondered why Finnegan hadn't asked me to stay behind as well. I'd been the one at the board, the one screwing around instead of working in my seat. On the grand list of detention getters, my name should have been at the top. I was thinking about this while I packed my bag, and then I looked up and found Nick, Charlie, and Marina standing around my desk. They were all staring at me like I'd gotten away with the biggest prank ever, which I suppose I had since Finnegan had let me go without even a warning.
Dude, Nick said, That was terrifying. I was having flashbacks to my geometry teacher. Thanks, I guess. I shouldered my bag and stood up, following them into the hall. I thought you were going to start taking points from Ravenclaw, said Marina. Gryffindor, and don't tempt me. I gave her my look of doom. Marina giggled. You're the one who ran interference for us with the librarian, right? She asked. Oh, yeah. I was surprised she remembered. That was really cool of you, said Nick. Thanks. It wasn't a big deal, I mumbled, a little embarrassed. But something about the way they'd phrased it stuck with me. They thought I'd done it for them, when the whole time I'd been so focused on the librarian catching Sadie that I hadn't thought about anyone else. It was strange to realize they'd all been there. Do we really have to wait for Sadie? Charlie asked, glancing impatiently down the hallway. Well, that would be the nice thing to do, said Nick. Good thing we're not nice, Charlie grinned. No, we really aren't, Nick said mock seriously. Speak for yourself, because I'm a darling, said Marina. You're the worst, Nick told her. You steal everything clever we say and use it in your fan fiction. Marina shot him a look. It's not stealing, it's recycling, she said. And whatever, you love it. You know what I love? Beating the line, said Charlie. Dude, there are like 500 better ways to phrase that. Nick laughed. I'd never heard anyone talk the way they did. Like, you got a gold star for each clever remark. It was smart, but not show-offy smart, like the guys from Model UN who always tried to prove that they knew more than you about some obscure topic they'd Wikipedia'd. This was more like seeing how self-deprecating you could be while still making everyone laugh. They all began to walk away toward the dining hall. I hesitated, unsure if I was supposed to follow, and after a couple of steps, Nick turned back around. Aren't you coming? He asked, like he'd expected me to join them all along. Yeah, I said gratefully, catching up. Of course.
Chapter 10, Sadie. The whole thing was Nick's fault, really. So if Finnegan should have kept anyone after class, it was him. But Nick got away with everything, while I always got caught. I could hear him and Charlie and Marina laughing out in the hallway as I approached Finnegan's desk. You wanted to talk to me? I asked. Finnegan sighed, looking all martyrish, like he deserved a medal for spending more time with one of us than he absolutely had to. Yes, Sadie, I did, he said. I know you were the one responsible for today's excitement. He actually called it that, excitement. Way to be overdramatic. What's so exciting about grading our work? I asked. And then he launched into this totally bullshit speech about how correcting the assignments in class puts unnecessary pressure on everyone and doing your best was enough without stressing over your grade and how I'd been at Latham long enough to know that. I don't want anyone getting sick because of the French homework, he said. You mean dying, I corrected. Because we're already sick. Finnegan gave me a watery sort of smile, like he preferred tiptoeing around the subject. Yes, he clarified. I mean dying. The word floated there in silence, neither of us knowing what to do now that he'd actually said it. Wow. Thanks for protecting us from dying of French homework, I said sarcastically. I was already in trouble, so what did it matter if I kept going? It's super cool of you to care so much. Sadie. I mean it. Thanks for teaching us how to tell the doctors in Paris that we think we might have a cough. That'll be useful when we're not even allowed to get on an airplane. I hadn't planned to go off on him, but I'd been up half the night listening to Natalie Zhang's crying through our shared wall. She did that sometimes, but never as badly as last night. I should have asked the nurse for a sleeping pill, but I'd stupidly suffered through it and had been in a terrible mood all morning. Sometimes I got so tired of Latham House that I wanted to scream. You know that scientists are working on, Finnegan began, but I didn't want to hear it. Developing a cure, I said flatly. Yeah,
So I've heard. Twice. And each time we get excited over rumors about some new medication, and then it turns out that the doctors fake the data, or the drug doesn't work, so I'm not exactly getting my hopes up.
I don't know what to tell you, Sadie. I want a cure as much as you do, and one day it'll happen. But until then, we're all stuck here.
I couldn't believe he'd said that. The we part. Nick had this theory that our teachers were all exposure positive and couldn't get hired anywhere else, even though there was like a 90% chance they'd never get sick. I'd always told him that was just a rumor. But something about the way Finnegan talked about being stuck made me think it might be true. But you're not stuck here, I said, because at the end of the day, you get to go home and go to restaurants and movie theaters and airplanes and not have anyone get worried that French homework might kill you. He didn't deny it. I'm late for lunch, and the line's going to suck, I said. And for the record, the grading papers thing, Nick started it, not me.
I very much doubt that, he said, shaking his head. But he let me go.
It was so annoying. Nick never got in trouble. He was too geeky, too eager, too out-of-his-way friendly with the adults. They never understood that he was making fun of them, pushing them to be nice and make conversation when they'd rather back away. No one believed that I wasn't dragging him feet first into our misanthropy, that actually we egged each other on. Of course, my friends hadn't waited for me after all. They'd taken advantage of the early dismissal and had gone through the line before it was enormous. Meanwhile, I was stuck at the back of it. I picked up my tray and glanced toward my table with a sigh. Everyone was already there. But something was different. I looked again, and sure enough, Lane Rosen was sitting at my lunch table. I'd been gone for like 2 minutes, and somehow, in that amount of time, my friends had adopted him. It was strange seeing him there, laughing at something Nick was saying, which was no doubt juvenile and only half as funny as he thought. But it wasn't a bad kind of strange, just different. I hadn't thought ahead to his finding a group and making friends. After we'd talked that night in the gazebo, sitting in the dark and splitting a side order of existential crisis, everything had felt different. He wasn't this grown-up version of a 13-year-old nightmare anymore. He was the new kid, with the perfect handwriting and clever remarks and sheepish grin, who never left his room and barely talked to anyone. I'd seen him sitting at Genevieve's table, looking miserable, and had considered inviting him over, but I hadn't known what to say or how my friends would react. And now they'd gone and casually invited him over for me. Or, I guess, not for me. They'd just gone and become friends with a guy who'd created a diversion in the library and taken my Darren French class, which, to be honest, I was still surprised about. I hadn't thought he had it in him. And now there he was, sitting at my table. Oh, God, what if they were talking about me? What if he was telling them embarrassing stories about our summer camp days? I fretted over it while I was stuck in the endlessly slow lunch line behind a couple of sophomores who couldn't make up their minds whether they wanted potato wedges or sweet potato fries. And then finally, I was through. I'd been so impatient that I'd grabbed a normal, boring lunch, and Linda got all smug about it, congratulating me on making healthy choices. When I got to my lunch table, it was like arriving late to a party. Not like I'd ever been to a real one, seeing as how I'd been Lathamized in the spring of my sophomore year, but it felt like everything had started without me. Charlie had already finished his lunch and was scribbling furiously in his notebook. Marina was leaning back in her chair, nibbling on a fry while she eavesdropped on the click of overly dramatic girls at the next table. And Nick was busy carving his veggie burger into some sort of art piece while Lane shook his head over it. "Hi," I said. Lane looked up at me with this huge smile, and I wished I'd said something cooler than hi, but too late.
Sadie.
He said my name like I was exactly the person he wanted to see most.
Sorry if you got in trouble with Finnegan.
It's not a big deal, I shrugged, playing it off. Although, Nick, you know your theory on the teachers being exposure positive? Nick was concentrating so hard on carving up his burger with the dull plastic knife that he was like, "Hmm? Are you even listening?" I grumbled, putting down my tray. Lane had taken the seat across from mine, which was usually empty. I was used to us being four people with plenty of room to spread out. The table felt fuller with him there and more cramped,
with just the one empty seat. What? Nick whined.
Forget it, I said. You suck. He did, too. I still hadn't forgiven him for backing out of our collection with Michael on Saturday night. At least he'd distributed his half, but still.
You say that, but only because you haven't yet feasted your eyes upon the genius of my latest invention, Nick bragged. He held up his tray in triumph. It didn't look all that impressive to me. Basically, he'd cored his veggie burger.
What is it? I asked.
I call it the Nut Burger. It's a portmanteau.
It's portmanteau-rable, I said, snorting.
I told him that, said Marina. It's 20% less burger and 20 times more pretentious.
Whatever, it's awesome, Nick said, taking a bite. Mustard and ketchup oozed out the middle of his Nut Burger and plopped onto his plate. Marina giggled.
Your prototype needs work, Lane said.
Because he was sitting across from me, we kept accidentally making eye contact. He'd smile a little and then glance away. It happened like 5 times, and whenever it did, I felt all fluttery. Lane's eyes flicked up and met mine for a 6th time, and then he grinned into his lunch tray. I'd remembered his eyes as hazel, but they were actually green, ringed with brown. He had those long, thick eyelashes, too. The kind that I couldn't even get with mascara. There was color in his cheeks, and he looked less exhausted than he had last week. Now that I wasn't still seething over the summer camp debacle, it was easy to see why the girls in my French class were so interested. Of course he'd had a girlfriend back home. I bet he was one of those drama club guys the girls all secretly had crushes on, or maybe class counsel. I couldn't place him. There was the flawless French, the preppy clothes, and the neat handwriting. And then there was the easy way he laughed, the witty comments, and that evil substitute teacher impression. It was like he thought he should be one thing, but secretly was another. Ugh, I wasn't this girl. This blushy girl who couldn't handle sitting across from a boy. Admittedly, a cute boy, who was staring at me like he thought I could read Morse eye contact. I took a bite of my burger, hoping that would quench the flutter. So, Lane, I said, how come you're not sitting in the Bible Belt anymore? He made a face.
I was sort of dying over there.
Well, now you can be sort of dying over here, Charlie said dryly.
Lane laughed and then looked embarrassed about it. Charlie went back to writing again, and Marina tried to read it over his shoulder, being super obvious.
Stop. Charlie muttered, edging his notebook away.
Ugh, you're no fun.
Marina pouted for a moment, and then her face lit up. Lane, you knew Sadie from before, right?
A little, he allowed. I tried to shoot Marina telepathic signals to shut up, but it didn't work, probably because I don't have superpowers.
So what's the story with you two? She asked. Sadie won't tell us anything.
If I could have kicked her under the table, I would have.
There's nothing to tell, Lane said, and I breathed a sigh of relief. We were 13 and went to the same summer camp. I pretty much thought girls had cooties back then.
I do have cooties, I said, and Marina almost choked on her juice.
Can we please call it that from now on? Asked Nick.
Sure, I said. I can just picture the final Facebook statuses. She fought a heroic but ultimately unsuccessful battle against a grave case of cooties.
Our little angel has gone on to a better place, a place free from cooties, Nick suggested.
Oh my God, stop. I was cracking up. We all were. But it wasn't funny. Not really. Being at Latham had warped our sense of humor until there we were, calmly eating our burgers while composing fictitious final Facebook statuses for hypothetically deceased teens.
That's why I deleted my Facebook, Charlie said. Preemptive strike.
None of us knew what to do with that. Charlie was the sickest of anyone in our group, and he was both the most and the least sensitive about discussing the future and the possibility of not having one.
I'm surprised Latham doesn't block the site, Lane said, and we all stared at him in horror. My high school blocked almost everything good on their computers.
Shh! Don't let them hear you, said Nick. Here, toss some salt over your shoulder. Nick held out the salt shaker and Lane took it, playing along. There, he said, throwing a pinch over his shoulder. Happy?
The internet gods require more sacrifice, said Nick. Quick, hop on one leg and touch your nose.
The internet gods require a sobriety test? Lane asked, and everyone laughed.
It was interesting the way he changed the dynamic of the table,
how much louder our laughter sounded, and how the five of us seemed to fill the space more. Watching him and Nick was fascinating. There was something that clicked about the two of them, like they'd been friends forever. Watching them goof around made all the ways that Nick annoyed me somehow seem entertaining. But Lane added another element I hadn't expected. Suddenly, our group felt disastrously co-ed. When I went to bust my tray, Lane followed me. Can you try not to kill me this time? I teased.
Even if it gives you an awesome final Facebook status?
I laughed. I deleted mine, too, I admitted. It had been too depressing, getting all those messages from classmates who had always ignored me, and it had been even more depressing a month later when they'd forgotten me again.
You're all crazy, he said. I'm keeping mine for bragging rights and for torturing ex-girlfriends.
So, how's that going? I asked, finding a slot for my tray.
It's weird, he said, pausing to gather his thoughts. I'm not sure. I haven't seen her for a month, so it feels like I'm brooding over something that happened forever ago.
The Latham time warp, I said. Sometimes a day lasts an hour, and sometimes it lasts a year.
That must be it. We've fallen through a hole in the space-time continuum.
And then Genevieve, sashayed over to the tray, returned with this sweet yet evil smile on her face.
Lane, she whined, where were you?
Oh, Lane said sheepishly. I sat with Nick.
I tried not to be disappointed that he hadn't said he'd sat with me.
Angela and Lee were so worried that something had happened when you didn't sit at our table.
She said it so dramatically that I snorted and she shot me a glare. She had to have noticed Lane sitting at our table, didn't she? I wish she'd leave the whole thing alone, since it was clear Lane couldn't wait to get away from them.
Nothing happened, Lane said, shrugging. I just decided to change it up.
There was this awkward silence where I swear Genevieve was waiting for him to apologize and promise he'd sit at her table for dinner. But he didn't.
Well, our Bible study is always open, she finally said.
Oh my God, you do know he's Jewish, right? I interrupted. Genevieve glared at me and I shrugged.
Jesus welcomes everyone to his table, she snapped, abandoning her tray on the condiment counter and flouncing away.
Lane picked up Genevieve's tray and added it to the return. Do you know who else welcomes everyone to their table? I asked. Anyone desperate for friends? He snorted.
Who are you calling desperate?
Nick interrupted, coming over with his tray.
Anyone who would date you.
I smiled sweetly.
Whatever, I'm awesome.
Nick bust his tray.
We have any plans this afternoon?
I shook my head.
Great, he said. Lane, how are you at first-person shooters?
Worse than I'd like. Nick grinned.
We can fix that.
And then Charlie came over to drop off his tray and the boys left for the dorms together. It was rest period, which most of the time I was fine skipping, but that afternoon I could feel myself starting to drag. Stupid Natalie Zhang and her loud, horrible sobbing. Everyone knew you were supposed to muffle it with your pillow if you didn't want the whole world to hear. As Marina and I walked back to the cottages, I could see Lane, Charlie, and Nick already scanning into their dorm. Nick was flailing excitedly about something, and they were all laughing.
The look on your face, Marina said.
That's just my face. It expresses a range of unprompted emotions.
Whatever. You're jealous that Nick stole your friend.
That's ridiculous, I said, because it was. They could go play video games if they wanted.
Seems pretty on point to me,
Marina said, grinning.
Unless, of course, he isn't your friend.
I rolled my eyes. What else would he be?
Who cares? He's adorable.
You think so? I asked a little warily,
As much as I didn't want to admit it, I liked Lane. A lot. And if Marina liked him too, I didn't know what would happen.
Just because I've sworn off Latham boys doesn't mean that I can't spot a cute one when he's literally sitting next to me.
Marina rolled her eyes.
Besides, I saw the way you were staring at each other during lunch. You two are so completely Pride and Prejudice.
You mean he'll scorn me for my family while convincing my sister's soulmate that he doesn't really love her?
I asked hopefully. Exactly, Marina laughed. But you forgot about the dirigibles and the talking wombats.
Marina trailed off, and I could tell that she was scripting out the story in her head, one with flying machines and snarky animals, and a happily ever after where no one died or got too sick to be a perfect love interest. But we were all too sick to be anyone's perfect love interest here, and it didn't matter how healthy anyone seemed. Any of us could wake up the next morning with blood splattered across the pillow and a hole in our lungs so painful that having a broken heart on top of it would have been unbearable. And even though I wasn't all that sick on the Latham scale, I was sick enough to know better. I was a stagnant case. I wasn't getting well enough to go home, but my x-rays weren't bad enough for Dr. Behrens to be all that concerned. It was like my body and TB had reached a state of equilibrium. Or maybe it was mutually assured destruction with both sides hovering over the big red button, but neither wanting to push first. A year ago, it had seemed like a miracle when the lesions on my lungs stopped forming and my blood tests evened out. But you can even get tired of miracles when they're not quite big enough to cure you. Because the thing about miracles is that they're not answers, no matter how much we want them to be. If anything, they're even more troubling questions. But then, Latham wasn't a place for answers. It was a place for waiting. And I had chosen a long time ago to wait here alone. I'm happier alone, I said.
Nope, I know you, Marina said. You're just telling yourself that because you don't want to get hurt.
No one wants to get hurt.
Well, maybe not, but sometimes it's worth it.
Marina shrugged, and I could tell she was thinking about Amit again.
I may have sworn off boys, but at least I tried them.
Marina?
What? Don't you want to? It won't cure you, but it sure makes you feel better, she said, giggling. He just broke up with his girlfriend, I pointed out, and Marina sighed like I was missing the point.
That's what I'm saying. He's so adorable that some girl continued dating him for weeks after she found out he was sick.
She grinned, like it was indisputable proof of his cuteness. And I laughed, supposing it was. Leave it to Marina to conjure a silver lining to Lane's horrible breakup story. And as much as I wished she didn't have a point, she kind of did. When it came to dating at Latham, there were no good options. The boys who stayed cute inevitably went home, and the boys who got sicker just wanted to lose their virginity as fast as possible to any girl willing. By Latham's standards of eligibility, Lane was pretty close to the top, and I was sure half the girls in our French class would be all too eager to take him into the woods and hook up, which was a particular pastime at Latham, in a way that eerily reminded me of summer camp. Except our ticking clock was far more depressing than Camp Griffith's. I wondered how often Marina thought about Amit, and what his life was like now that he'd gone home. And I wondered if Amit thought about Marina, or the rest of us still at Latham, even though he'd mostly hung out with those RPG-obsessed boys in Cottage 8. Marina and I scanned into our dorm, and this awful group of girls was already at the table in the micro-kitchen painting their nails. They did this super-involved nail art for hours and stank up the common lounge with their polish remover and reinforced Nietzsche's theory that hell is other people.
Show tunes? Marina asked as we went upstairs.
She kept trying to get me into Broadway musicals, as though hearing her Spring Awakening soundtrack for the fifth time would suddenly make me sing along with her. But it wouldn't. Show tunes depressed me. I didn't see the point in listening to songs from musicals I might never see. I really want to finish this book, I lied, instead of just telling the truth that I was embarrassingly excited for nap time. Lane sat with us again at dinner, putting down his tray along with Nick and Charlie.
The three of them were in the middle of a ridiculous argument about whether it was sacrilege to put ketchup on hot dogs.
You do know you're eating chicken fingers, right?
Marina asked, looking concerned. It's the principle of the thing, Nick told her. We're having a debate.
What you're having is chicken fingers, I corrected, which go with basically every dipping sauce you can think of.
That's how the whole thing started, Lane explained. Hot dogs are exclusionary, but the chicken finger welcomes all sauces, Charlie interrupted. All hail the food of the proletariat, the chicken finger.
And then he shoved an entire chicken finger in his mouth and choked, dissolving into a coughing fit. Marina rolled her eyes. I was with her. Our table felt overwhelmingly full of boys. It reminded me of those groups from my high school, the ones that crammed too many people around a table and were so unintentionally loud that you couldn't help paying attention. I'd always stared wistfully at those groups across the cafeteria, wondering how they'd happened and why they always seemed to happen without me. But then, everything always seemed to happen without me. I was feeling a lot better after my nap, though, and less like I wanted to shout at Finnegan about French homework again. Which reminded me. Hey, Nick, I said. Finnegan said something earlier to go with your ex-pause theory.
Told you, Nick gloated. Lane was like, ex-pause theory?
So I explained it to him, and he nodded solemnly.
It makes sense, he said. I was wondering why anyone would sign up to, be around us, Nick supplied with a grin.
Don't make me feel sorry for Finnegan, Marina warned.
I mean, ugh!
I'm not, I said. I just thought it was interesting.
Like, maybe they're not terrified of us. Maybe they're scared that they could wake up tomorrow and be us, Charlie said.
No, shut up, shut up, shut up, Marina said, covering her ears. Charlie smirked, pleased that he'd annoyed her.
It's, what, a 10% chance you get sick if you're exposure positive? Lane said.
Exactly. I shrugged. You're not contagious, you're not sick, you probably won't get sick, but you stay up all night freaking out anyway. One of my friends back home had that. What I didn't add was how she'd sent me this horrific Facebook message accusing me of giving it to her, even though we'd been diagnosed within 2 days of each other, so obviously there was a nefarious third party to blame. Thankfully, our dinner conversation drifted to other things then, and we got onto the subject of movies, which, with Marina around, inevitably led to Miyazaki films, her particular passion. It turned out Lane had never seen one.
Not one? Nick asked incredulously.
Not Princess Mononoke
or Totoro?
Marina pressed. Lane shook his head. That's it, I said. Tonight we're watching a movie.
So we did.
Marina and I went over to the boys' dorm after dinner, which technically we weren't supposed to do, but we'd figured out a way. Marina and I went back to our dorm first and waited for someone to leave so we could slip out after them, avoiding the scan pad.
How much trouble can we get into for having a girl in our room?
Lane asked as he led us up the stairs. Why? Are you planning on sneaking a girl into your room? I teased. We're going to Nick's room, not yours.
Right, he mumbled. That came out wrong.
Marina shot me this knowing look, which I pretended I hadn't seen, and then Nick poked his head out of his room and was like, quick, get in here. Nick's room was a total nerd cave, even though he clearly thought it was the best thing ever. His posters were things like Game of Thrones and Doctor Who, and his desk was set up with a video game console and this fancy cinema display. He didn't talk about it much, but I knew his dad was one of those rich tech guys. A lot of kids at Latham were like that, and a lot were on assistance, like Charlie. I'd brought some contraband snacks with me, and I dumped them on the bed while Nick set up the movie. Lane stared at the bags of sour candy and peanut butter cups like he'd never expected to see junk food again.
Sadie always has contraband,
Charlie explained, opening the bag of peanut butter cups.
It's why we put up with her.
Oh, whatever, I pretended to be mad. Nick does too. He just went to the extra special preschool where they learned math instead of how to share.
Nick sighed, opened a desk drawer, and tossed a water bottle into the pile.
Vodka, he said.
What was that about not sharing again?
Where did you get this stuff? Lane asked, which I guess I'd been expecting. There was only so long you could be at Latham without noticing the contraband bags of chips or the water bottles of booze at weekend movie nights without asking someone where it came from. I'm a coyote, I said. I help illegal goods cross the border into Latham. He laughed, thinking it was a joke, and then realized I wasn't kidding.
What else can you get?
He asked. Name it, I said. Wait, Lane said. You do this for real? Nick and I do. We're the kingpins of the black market. We'd inherited the responsibility about 9 months ago from this kid Philip who'd gone home, which was about the time Nick had inherited an interest in dating me, although I'd quickly let him know that was never going to happen.
That mixed metaphor was painful, Nick said, wincing.
How painful? On a scale of 1 to 10, I prompted.
Screw you, Nick said, not meaning it.
And 7.
And then we watched Spirited Away, which I hadn't